House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order, May 28th, our last opportunity to act on bills. And we have two before us, before an informational meeting. We'll start with a work session on Senate Bill 963. Barbara, if you could remind us or attempt to give us a little summary of a big bill.
Tiny bill.
Yeah.
SB 963A revises certain provisions governing homeowners associations in planned communities and condominiums.
Thank you very much. We have some experts who are with us today, Barbara Canston and Rich Vile. Whichever order makes the most sense, please go ahead.
Go ahead, Lori.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Skillman. I'm a manager with the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency, and I am a member of the working group that worked on Senate Bill 963 plus the amendments. And I did hand out just a one-pager testimony for you. The bill, as you know, was a result of a collaboration between developers' attorneys, association attorneys, homeowner association management groups, the county surveyors, and the real estate agency. And I'm just going to address the Dash 6 amendments that are before you today. The bill is a large bill, and the bill is a large bill because there are parallel provisions in the Planned Community Act and the Condominium Act. And I don't know if you know this, but the real estate agency is the agency that reviews and approves condominiums in this state. And so we have a real interest in making sure that those statutes that we have regulatory authority over are clear for people who file documents with us. But the provisions regarding associations for planned communities and condominiums parallel each other almost exactly. So changing one thing in Chapter 94 will result in a parallel change in 100. So the bill's twice as long because there are two statutes it's covering. The original bill had a significant number of amendments right before it passed out of the Senate. A large chunk of those amendments had to do with splitting a statute in Chapter 100 for condominiums that covered plats and plat amendments into two separate statutes so that we would have the all of the provisions for plats remaining in ORS 100-115 and then create a whole new statutory section for plat amendments, for supplemental plats, for corrections and to plats and how those would be handled. The amendments, although they look long, probably about 4 pages of those amendments is a new section 26A, and it has one change in it, and it is what I would suggest is what I would call a substantive change to 963. When a condominium filing comes before the agency, they are asking for the review and approval of their declaration and of their bylaws. The agency approves those, and they also approve any amendments to those documents. When the agency signs and delivers those documents back to typically the developer's attorney for recordation, the statutes currently allow for a period of 2 years from the time the commissioner gives approval for those documents for recordation. Well, I've been there now 3.5 years, and that's way too long. One of the big problems that happens is that when the statutes change, those documents should be correct statutorily as of date of recordation. And if they get 2 years, the statutes can change significantly. And they should not be recorded at that time. They need to be recorded as of the statutes that exist at that time. So we always have a lot to do right before and after statutes change. But 2 years is just excessive. So we changed that to 1 year. Well, 4 pages of the Dash 6 amendments have to do with that one word change from 2 years to 1 year for bylaw amendments. But the rest of them, we went through this very long bill and read it very carefully, particularly with the amendments to 100-115, we just found that it needed some clarification, a little tightening up of the language so that the people who are unit owners or homeowners in those associations can read and understand the language really well. I am kind of a stickler about plain language and simple language. So a lot of that was the real estate agency, and that's why we're before you today.
Thank you very much.
If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer any of them.
Let's hear from the whole panel, and then I imagine we will have some questions.
Rich Vile, attorney with Vile Fotheringham. As I testified earlier, our firm represents about 2,000 homeowner associations in the market area, and our firm has on staff Barbara Kahns, who's a full-time legislative assistant that has also coordinated the task force or group that Lori just referred to, which is comprised of lawyers like myself who represent associations, lawyers who represent developers of associations, management companies, service providers, etc. And so I can tell the committee that there have been no concerns raised about the bill and its amendments as we've gone through this process. Lori represents a relatively narrow part of it because she's dealing with the developer side, but I have talked to the developer attorneys and they're perfectly satisfied with the changes that were made. I did receive one phone call from the cable television industry about a section of the bill. I believe that we were able to clear up the unclarity that was raised in that phone call. As I testified before, this bill is merely a collaboration attempt to fix things like how do boards meet, what's our quorum requirements. One of the things that you might find interesting is that one of the issues was that management agreements entered into by the developer before turnover of control to the association were limited, and with some work from some folks that are very, I think, interested in the topic, we excluded, for example, performance-based energy or water efficiency kinds of contracts so that people could actually enter into longer-term contracts that would allow some of those eco issues to be adequately addressed. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have about the bill. It is long. It's primarily long because, as Lori said, we have to say everything twice, and often we're changing a few words in 4 pages of text, but because it's all one section of the Condominium Act or the Planned Community Act, we don't have any choice but to include the entire text of that section in the bill itself.
It's a bit reminiscent of a bill we heard this morning in the Revenue Committee where 44 pages of an amendment were actually about 5 pages of substance and the rest conforming.
Chair Reed, I think that's an accurate observation about this one as well.
Ms. Kantz, did you have anything to add?
No, Chair Reed, not really for the record. Other than I have to say, having in a prior life had lawyer's responsibilities, I certainly concur with reducing the 2 years to 1 year, particularly in this economic climate. Folks are kind of holding off and couple that with the legislative changes, 1 year, it certainly makes sense. And the 2 years, because I was involved with the 2 years, it was sort of like, well, what's reasonable, and it wasn't really any great rationale for it in the first place.
Thank you. And I realized I led you on a little bit astray by not encouraging you to identify yourself for the record.
Barbara Kahns.
So I have a couple of questions, but let me ask the committee if they have any before I ask mine. Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious in one part of the bill. Just it's probably maybe not a really smart question, as Representative Gilliam will probably submit to. But I was interested when you submit a copy of the proposed plat amendment. In there, it mentions submitting the original or a copy. And so I'm reading through there. Why is that mention of the original in there? Is there a requirement that something has to be done with the original?
Mr. Chair, through the chair, Representative Holvey, the way that plats are reviewed and approved is that they're reviewed and approved concurrently by the state, by the real estate agency, and by the county, the surveyors and the tax and assessor's office. And what the tax office and the assessor's office gets and what they use is they put the plats on Mylars, and those are permanent documents that they have in their records. So that would be the original. What the agency needs is a full-size paper copy of the plat that's signed and notarized by all the declarants and the counties and the surveyor, so that we know that they're telling us this is the plat that we're going to record in the county. So the county gets originals, we get paper copies of them.
Chair Reed, Representative Holvey, that doesn't preclude someone from making multiple originals if they want to, and that's why it says either or. But typically, as Lori explained, that's the process, is the county gets the original, the state gets the copy.
So the county does always get an original?
Absolutely.
Okay, it just wasn't clear to me. Thank you.
Any other questions? So I wondered, you mentioned, Mr. Violet, that you were able to clear up some misunderstanding or potential misunderstanding with the cable television industry. Could you say some more about that, please?
Sure. The call I got, Mike. Oh, good. I haven't met him before, and I'm sorry I've forgotten your last name,
Dewey.
Mike.
Dewey.
Mike Dewey. We talked on the phone yesterday about Section 12. Section 12 is an attempt, once again, to conform to the Condominium Act section that deals with a particular type of problem. The problem is this. In an effort to balance the needs of individual homeowners who buy into a project, have a right to the common areas, with the needs of the board of directors to make decisions about allowing easements, et cetera, across that common area, we have said that easements in excess of 2 years require 80%, now 75% of the owners to approve those easements.
So you're saying it was 80%, now 75%?
And it wasn't clear. Unfortunately, there was an 80% requirement. It really wasn't clear whether that covered the types of easements that we talked about with Mr. Dewey. In fact, there were arguments being made by some lawyers that it required 100%. So in an effort to clear that up, we adopted the same thing that the Condominium Act has, which is the 75% requirement, and made it clear that with that 75% vote, it can be the easement can be granted in excess of 2 years. The question also that Mike asked me was, what does that do to easements created before the turnover meeting by the developer? In other words, if the developer comes in, says this project needs conduit for cable TV and creates easements on the plat, that's not affected. It's not like the owners can overturn that after they take control. That is in place, and it's not going to go away. So I think that the problem is not really one that we have made it worse. In my opinion, we have made it much better for the industry by making it clear in the Planned Community Act as it currently is in the Condominium Act. Now, I need to be quick, however, to say that this does not change the contracts and service providers rules. Throughout the country, and Oregon is no exception, and we've been this way for many years, you cannot enter into a management contract, what we used to call in the 80s the sweetheart deal, where a developer basically hires his wholly owned company as the manager, or he hires his brother-in-law's company as the service provider, and have that survive turnover. So the application to Mr. Dewey's industries is the easement is there for all of the cable to go through, for all of the infrastructure to exist, but that doesn't mean that the service contract itself necessarily is cast in stone. It can be overturned. That hasn't changed. We've not messed with that at all. It's been that way for at least 20 years in Oregon, and I don't want to mislead anyone that we're making a change to that, because we are not.
Thank you. I think that's very helpful. I'll ask Mr. Dewey to come up in a little bit and see if give him a chance to give his impression as well. The other two questions I think are pretty simple. One, I heard you say that the task force and the committee generally felt good about the bill and the amendments. Was it simply a misunderstanding or something that was missed in the Senate that caused the need for the amendments, or what caused that?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, we simply ran out of time on the Senate side to fix some very technical tweaks that occurred at Legislative Council's office.
Thank you. That's
and so the deal we made with the Senate committee was we promise we'll get these fixed and bring them back.
So the amendments are still an attempt to reflect what your original understanding was, an intent.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. And then the last question I had was just, I don't think anybody else on this committee had the privilege that I did last session serving on the Judiciary Committee, where we had a similar bill. So I remember some of this, certainly not all the detail, but could you give us a little context of, is this a regular event, so we're going to see you again in the next version? Or
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I would love to tell you that we're done, because this is a pain for us, as you can imagine. The last few years have been remarkably active in terms of the number of projects built and problems that have arisen because of the huge increase in planned communities and condominiums in the state. With the slowdown in building, it's quite possible we don't need this kind of bill for a while. However, I will tell you that most states, including many of our immediate relatives to the north, south, and east, have actually now established standing committees in their legislatures that deal only with homeowner associations. That's how big the issue is. We are seeing growth in these like you cannot imagine, and the number of issues that comes up is certainly not anywhere short of what comes up in a municipality. It is a ton of issues that come up. So I would love to promise you won't see us next session. I can't do that.
I think you've just gotten Representative Galizio and Representative Gilliam really excited about the prospect of chairing a committee. giving them hope for the session here.
Chairman, they might want to talk to me before they consider chairing a committee.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions in this panel? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Dewey, Representative Gilliam, did you? Oh, you were, I saw you waving.
Oh, I saw.
Okay. All right. Just checking out the.
Chairman, do you want me to wait and stay here?
That'd be fine. Yes, please.
Okay, sir,
Mr. Dewey, if you'd like to give us your impression quickly. I always like to be the facilitator of new friendships. So
yes,
glad to get to meet the witness table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, the cable telecom industry. Also speaking on behalf of the other telecom entities like Quest in the back of the room, Verizon, and OTA, we're always unified, as you know, on a lot of issues. Having said that, Representative Polvy and Spivey, the stipulation by Representative Gilliam, I think you always ask.
It's
a very good question.
It's Gilman, by the way.
Yeah. Can't hear you.
Yeah, you're out
of here.
This must be our last committee.
I do think I have other standing here, and that I do own a condominium, and I do appreciate the reason for wanting to take a look at this, because I can note that there are issues from time to time with homeowners. And I appreciate Mr. Vile and the opportunity we had to talk. I just wanted to put on the record that with regard to Section 4 and the two-year language, this is in the 4A large B, there is the provision for easements that last longer than 2 years or right-of-ways that the Board of Directors will approve those. And what is likely to occur prior to the transfer of the property to the Homeowner Association, there is a contract with the developer to put in the easements, and those are usually, because of a cost consideration and to recoup your costs, 10 to 15 years, and we didn't want that to aggravate or nullify that particular situation with regard to the contract. And Mr. Vale says that that isn't the intent, that that contract would stand when the terms and conditions are finished. Then the Homeowner Association would I assume, meet with the provider, and there would be a discussion about the ongoing relationship. And I would assume that it would be longer than 2 years just because of the cost factors. But I did want to put on, Mr. Chair, that on the record to be clear that that was not the case, because one of my clients did find some concern with that.
Thank you very much. So I'm hearing you correctly. You're okay with it,
yes,
as written now that we have it clarified.
Yes.
Very good. Any questions for Mr. Dewey? You haven't provoked him sufficiently. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we're in work session. We have the -A6 amendments, and we also have the fiscal and revenue statements. Am I right about that,
Correct.
Barbara?
Correct. Okay. Correct.
So this bill is ready to go to the floor, should we so choose.
Mr. Chair, yes, I'd like to make a motion.
Please.
I like having the script. It's great. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -6 amendments dated May 27, 2009.
Thank you. Representative Galizio moves to adopt the -A6 amendments to Senate Bill 963 dated May 27, 2009. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. The -A6 amendments are adopted. Representative Galizio.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 963A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Galizio moves Senate Bill 963A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. Senate Bill 963 as amended heads to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Bentz, you are a hero if you're willing to carry this.
I am willing to carry it.
Thank you very much. Representative Benz will carry, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 963. And I've lost my agenda now. Open a work session on Senate Bill 863. Barbara.
SB 863 authorizes Economic and Community Development Department to reimburse local filmmaker for all or portion of expenses paid in Oregon to produce smaller films using Oregon residents for production.
Thank you. I recognize that I had to leave you last time. You had what I understand was a pretty robust discussion on this bill, and I'm interested to bring it back for your further consideration. What's interesting to me about this bill is two things. I've shared this with some of you individually. I like the idea that by making the some of these funds specifically aimed at local filmmakers, we may help develop that industry in Oregon and the local talent that's here, helping professionalize that industry. And secondly, as we move, as I think we should, away from a straight competition on price, if we can develop our own specialties and expertises, this will, I think, help facilitate that. So that's one of the reasons I'm interested in it, and I'm open to other discussion. We may be able to move very quickly, too, if people are amenable. Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm
curious, after, you know, thinking about this bill a little bit, was there ever any issues brought up about the, I guess, making a credit like this only for local folks as opposed to others? I mean, as far as that being constitutional or fair?
Of course, Representative Hawley, I was not here for the hearing you had in this committee. Drawing on my own experience in the Revenue Committee, I would say there are plenty of examples where we offer tax treatment to people in state that's not available to those out of state. I'm no constitutional scholar, but we could ask Representative Vence for an opinion on that, perhaps. But I think the idea of devoting some to local participants in the industry is a good thing. Is there other discussion? Representative Thatcher.
Well, I think this is an interesting discussion because we're talking about two different things. We've got the overall, should we be subsidizing the film industry specifically? And if we are, which we already established that we will, because I think we passed that last session, if I'm not mistaken, last session or the session before. Anyway, so if we are, then should we set, the whole point of that being to bring in business that wouldn't otherwise be here. So now we're saying, but business that's already here is going to benefit from it too. So it's kind of interesting. And do we really, like he says, pick one industry as that one's going to get taxpayer money? That one just doesn't sit right with me, and I'm having a hard time with this issue, even though I know it's taking an existing program, it's not expanding it, it's all in the name of getting local people to benefit. But I just can't jump over that hurdle right now, especially in light of the budget.
I appreciate the distinction you're making about the refinement versus expansion. I appreciate that, but I hear your concern. Representative Wade?
I just to follow up on that, I mean, if we're saying that 5% of this goes to local, I think that's what's in the bill.
Yes.
I mean, does that somehow imply that that's all they can get?
No. I don't believe so. I think that, Representative Hawley, I think that means that it's a minimum to that, and I'm looking for... on page 2, line 3, 95%, line 34, sorry, section 2, subsection 3, 95% are continuously appropriated for the purposes of making reimbursements to filmmakers. And then on line 40, 5% are continuously appropriated to local filmmakers. So I think 5% is limited to locals. The other 95% is not limited. So it could be to locals or to...
I just wanted to make sure that was on the record, that locals were eligible for that other 95% as well.
Yeah, great question. Right.
You know, trying not to fall off the smartometer on the question.
I think you got credit for that one from your colleague there. That's good. Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I am so enthusiastic about this bill that I am already eagerly anticipating and awaiting the next biennial shakedown by the film industry.
Is that a motion?
It's an emotion.
Any further discussion? I don't see any. Are we ready for a motion?
I think so. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill H-63 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Glizio moves Senate Bill H-63 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion we haven't already had? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see
any. Yes, there's objection to the motion.
Okay.
That's a direct question, and the answer, that's fine.
Is there any other objection to the motion? Let's have the record reflect that Representative Thatcher votes no, and all others vote aye. We can save a little time since we're so quick. And the motion carries. Senate Bill 863 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there anyone who would like to carry that?
I think Representative Gilliam could speak well to that.
Oh, please, no.
The economic benefits.
I'd be happy to do it as long as I know it's irritating Representative Holden.
Representative Gilliam will carry.
Thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 863. We do have a couple of people here to help us with a little bit of an informational meeting. And I think the title that's on our agenda is a little bit misleading, and I'll take the blame for that. What I was hoping we could do just in a little bit of time is to have a little discussion, sort of organized around the assumption and perhaps hope on my part that this committee can continue into the interim as we begin to transition that direction and think about where we might go. One of the original questions I'd asked as we started the committee was, how do we grow the economy while supporting the environment? And so Linda Navarro and Wayne Embry are here to kind of help us think about what we might be doing in the interim, where we might be going, where some of the important questions we should be thinking about and asking. So I invite both of you forward if you're willing, and let you get us started. And not everyone, I think, has the background of your background, Mr. Embry, so if you wouldn't mind starting with your with a little bit of how you come to be before us.
Sure.
Thanks.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for asking me to be here today. I'm Wayne Embry. I'm managing partner of Reference Capital Management, a Tigard-based seed and startup stage venture capital firm. We've been in business since the mid-1980s, and since that time, we've invested in energy, environmental, life science, and information technology companies throughout the Northwest and Western Canada. So over the 23 years we've been in business, we've invested in probably about 125 companies. About half of those are based here in Oregon. A large percentage of our companies are based on technologies out of research universities. So we've started companies out of every one of the research universities in Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, Alberta, and several across the country, California, the East Coast, and a few out of Europe. One of the reasons that Chair Reed asked that I come and talk to you is, a few years ago we separated our funds into two different categories, one that's exclusively focused on energy and environmental opportunities, and the other focused on life sciences. And so in the last 18 months, we've invested in seven new companies in the region. Five of those are in Oregon, one's in Idaho, one's in Seattle. All these are either focused on energy opportunities, sustainability, clean tech, sort of whatever category you feel most comfortable with. And probably within the next month, we'll make two additional investments, one in a company in California that's is a solar technology, and another Oregon-based company that's and roughly in the semiconductor test equipment business, but semiconductor equipment focused primarily on solar cells and solar efficiency. Interesting from a time perspective, one of my early jobs out of graduate school in the early 1980s was working for a predecessor to this committee, the Joint Committee on Trade and Economic Development, and going through a recession that, frankly, from my perspective, is worse than this one, and looking at things that the Assembly and the state could do from a perspective on economic development. Of course, at that time, the lottery was brand new, and so the money at that time was constitutionally mandated to go towards economic development. So there was the promise of large lottery dollars being available for some of the economic programs that the state was considering at the time. And given that as just kind of a quick background, I'd be happy to go on any discussion, any direction you'd like to go.
Thank you very much. I'm sort of ad-libbing here, but I wonder if maybe we should hear from Ms. Navarro too, kind of an orientation, then we can keep a broad-ranging discussion going, if that's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association. I apologize to those of you who had to hear me and members yesterday for a full hour, but it's a pleasure to be here. I might be in the category of people slightly misled by the title, so I apologize. I'm not as prepared, I think, as Mr. Embry to talk specifically about some of the sustainability efforts, although
let me save you a little bit on that. Okay. I apologize for interrupting. I think what I'm interested in, hopefully the committee is, as well as the intersection between that. So the general state of the economy and its credit and lending is a very important element of that. I just didn't want us to start now thinking that that was the outer bounds of that discussion. So
okay, perfect.
What you have to contribute will be very important, I think.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that clarification. I'll speak briefly and then be happy to respond to questions. Just real quickly on the issue of sustainability and economic development, many of our banks are, I will note, developing new eco-banking initiatives and working on a number of projects to try to provide credit that's needed in those spaces. But overall, I'll just clarify, the Oregon Bankers Association represents traditional depository institutions, so that is banks that have brick and mortar in their communities. They take deposits and they lend those deposits back out. We only constitute, as you'll see in the handouts, if you look, I did provide three full-color handouts. If you flip to the second handout, that's titled Financial Institution Credit, I think this is an important context to understand. Traditional banks at one point, even going into, even in as recently as the 80s, occupied almost 70% of the total U.S. credit markets. But as credit in this country exploded in the 90s and in the earlier part of this decade, the percentage of bank credit as a percentage of total credit has dropped to less than 30%. So the banks that I represent, traditional banks that are regulated and take deposits and have presence in their communities, amount to about just under 30% of total credit. This is important because, as you've undoubtedly read, heard, and probably heard from anecdotal examples from constituents, there's been a contraction in credit. But it's misunderstood at times about the contraction being in the traditional banking industry. In fact, in the last six recessions, credit declined in traditional banking. That's the norm. This recession, unusually, credit actually grew at least through 2008, 12% for business and 9% for consumers in traditional banking. So they're picking up some market share as other components of the credit markets have exited. But there's absolutely no way traditional banks are going to make up for credit that was available in the broader markets in droves going into this recession. So that's some context to validate the point, and this is national statistics. The first slide of that three-page handout shows the growth through 2008. We have experienced some tapering off, primarily due to some of the largest banks contracting credit somewhat in first quarter, but I did include the FDIC's news release that came out this week with the results of all FDIC-insured banks talking about their performance, and it does clarify that the assets for three-quarters of traditional banks actually, and we're a reflection of that here in Oregon, actually grew in first quarter as well, assets being the loans that they make, because, as I said, the vast majority of banks in this state are what you'd call plain vanilla. They take deposits and they make loans. Capital is leveraged through deposits and borrowed funds, but primarily deposits because regulators don't like borrowed funds. And that's, and so their ability to continue to lend in the communities in Oregon really boils down to regulations that provide for that, accounting rules that provide for that, because those can be very punitive, and some banks are facing that right now, as well as deposits. And the up until this recession, the competition for deposits was particularly fierce and challenging for banks in this state. but they are seeing some return of market share with deposits because people do understand the safety and security that comes with FDIC insurance. So that's kind of maybe dispelling some of the myths about traditional banking, but acknowledging where the contraction is. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, capital position of these banks, liquidity, and the pressures on liquidity, not just the deposits they can take in, but, again, the rules that are applied and how they have to write down loans and provision for loan losses, it's not an arbitrary decision for the banks. It's mandated and regulated. Same goes for credit decisions. It's going to depend on the health and viability of the businesses that are applying for loans. There's lots of credit available. It is dependent on which bank we're talking about at any given moment. But as a whole, in this state, there are the majority of banks are actively lending. But it's a little more challenging for most Oregon businesses in this environment to meet the credit standards. And those credit standards are fairly clearly defined for banks by the regulators. You have to ask first, how are you going to repay this loan? And second, if that doesn't work, how are you going to repay this loan? Meaning, what's your source of collateral? And collateral, if it's real estate dependent loan, is really challenged right now. Really challenged. I will make a brief comment about mortgage lending. Mortgages for our member banks, at least anecdotally, have skyrocketed recently. But part of that is, again, recapturing market share that exited the banks for a number of years, and the rates right now and programs that help folks refinance troubled mortgages and get in their home. So I think that lending activity, coupled with being prepared to withstand this recession and lend going forward, at least as a whole, again, individual banks are facing their challenges, is what's going to really drive economic development. Our banks primarily all lend to small business. That's their niche. And it will continue to be, especially in Oregon. And so we see that continuing for years to come. We have banks that are over 100 years old in this state. I expect many of our member banks to be here for years to come. But it all boils down to our economy. And we're a reflection of the economy in which we do business. And as businesses can thrive in our economy, so will the credit that would be extended to them. So with that, I'll stop and offer to answer any questions or participate in any discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any, I think we're wide open now. I have a few questions, but I want to give other people an opportunity to represent Thatcher.
I have a question. It doesn't really have to do much with sustainability and economic development so much, but I've heard rumor, and as we know, there's a lot of rumor mongering right now, that it's harder to get a loan on a house if it's been on the market more than 6 months. Is there any truth to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I haven't heard that same rumor. I don't know that to be true. It really depends on the borrower, their income, verifying their ability to repay, and then assessing, appraising, and determining, you know, the value of the property. I don't think that that value is necessarily dependent on how long it's been on the market. There, I would say that certain sectors of certain people who were able to get mortgage loans in the past are having challenges. I haven't heard it attributed to the length of time the property has been on the market. More, it's people who didn't qualify for traditional mortgage products in the past who had, you know, you've heard the expression, if you had a pulse, you could get a mortgage. Well, a lot of those mortgage products aren't available anymore, and a lot of the lenders that made those mortgage loans aren't lending anymore. And so there's challenges in mortgage lending, absolutely, but I don't think it's tied to the value or to the length of time the property is.
Thank you. Maybe I could ask you sort of a general question that you could both respond to. If we sit here at the end of our legislative session, we're looking forward, hopefully, towards an economic recovery. Hopefully, we're going to have something to say about what that looks like, either as a proactive result of the things we've done in this legislative session, or when we come back in the next time, kind of responding to it. What would you both see as the real opportunities going forward? How can we best be operating in that context? I didn't prepare you for these questions, but...
Chair Reed, members of the committee, one of the questions we've been asking ourselves, that same question, looking at the economy and looking at the amount of money that's gone in through the starting with TARP and economic recovery in the current budget at the federal level and also at the state level, and kind of boiling down to two very simplistic choices. One is, are we going to recover with the $50 Happy Meal inflation and that, or are we going to recover through innovation? And certainly our preference would be to lean towards a model more driven by innovation in new companies, which bring new dollars into the economy, as opposed to seeing one that's driven by inflation. So I think clearly policies that lean towards a more innovation favorable set of practices and expectations, as opposed to waiting for just to see what's going to happen, wait for the other shoes to drop, I think is one where activism is more favored than sitting and waiting. But also doing it around mechanisms that don't require large expenditures of dollars. So maybe capturing some of the things that are already out there, or looking for strategic relationships. So I think even the state can do that. Something we encourage all of our portfolio companies to do is to look for strategic partners. And I think, when you look at the one of the things we corresponded on, the legislation around conservation and efficiency in homes and other buildings, there's a wide range of opportunities there for relationships with utilities, with contractors, with and I believe also technology companies, to increase the likelihood that we don't have to go through this again, and build intelligence into buildings so that we get better communication between homes on a block, buildings within a city, and then onto the grid after that, so that we improve the flow of information as it relates to the production of electricity and the consumption of electricity, and reduces the losses that we have in that system that benefits everybody. And I think a lot of those things can be done around public policy and don't require dollars. So that's the real quick.
Appreciate that start, and especially the $50 Happy Meal term. We may be, I suspect I might be using that as a shorthand later on. I'll try to attribute it to
you.
It's very good. Ms. Rao, do you have any thoughts on that sort of general question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We've been so keenly focused right now on and we've seen government demonstrate its creativity at the federal level in the last year, and we've been very focused on these programs and truly what they end up meaning to banks here in Oregon and to credit availability here in Oregon. And one of the outcomes of that that's been challenging is reconciling how you can put the right parameters around the unregulated and underregulated segments of the credit markets and lenders that we believe contributed substantially to the housing bubble in particular. But how do you do that and still keep credit flowing and balance that with the need? There's absolutely a role for non-banks to play in facilitating credit. So I think that's an issue that's important for not only the federal government, but states, state legislatures, to look at and to talk with industry about and figure out what is the right parameters there, because we have to be careful, I guess, without trying to sound too cautious in policies that ignore the long-term, what we have seen can be disastrous implications of, kind of turning a blind eye in the hopes that you're just stimulating the economy. So there's some balancing there. For us, and for banking in particular, I will say that there's some pretty substantial regulatory pressures right now, and I have some concerns as president of the OBA in the long-term viability of a wide range of banks and financial services providers. Consumers and businesses benefit from lots of choices, and the more choices there are, the more competition there is for that business, and the lower prices are, and the better it is for those businesses. And in the public policy arena, particularly in the federal regulatory arena, the pressures are so intense, particularly on community banks, and a number of them right here in Oregon, that I have some concern about the long-term survival, even the short-term survival of some of our banks, and even after this recession, whether community banking, the regulatory burden becomes too great for community banks to be able to compete with their large brethren. So I think that needs to be part of the debate, too. How do our banks, headquartered here in the state of Oregon, continue to be viable small business lenders? Because they do know their customer, just like our large banks, and they're the ones that are going to fund innovative projects because they're going to know those customers, know what they're trying to accomplish, and know how it benefits their community. So I would add that to the discussion, too. So.
Just to clarify, am I hearing you suggesting that community banks have more of a focus? There is more of a distinctive advantage for the local small businesses to be interacting with community banks?
I'm not saying that, Mr. Chair, only because many of our largest banks doing business in this state are actually kind of like big community banks. We're fortunate in this state because even the largest market share leader in the state, U.S. Bank, has 100 and some branches and a very, very much a presence in their local community, and they're the number, I think Portland is, as they said yesterday, was their number one market in the country for SBA lending. So they're very much focused on small business lending as well. But I think that the competition and the role of community banks, if you look at the amount of credit extended to small local businesses by community banks and innovative new businesses by community banks, is significant, and I'm concerned about the non-systemically significant bank and its ability to weather this recession, not so much because they can't do it, because they have that relationship with customers, they take their deposits, they loan those back out, most remain well capitalized, but again, because the one-size-fits-all regulations or accounting rules are putting tremendous pressure on those banks, particularly when they get in a state of trouble. As I said, I think yesterday, and I've said many times to many business groups, if you're going down the road and you go off the road and you're in the shoulder, what you have to do is correct yourself and get back on the road. But some of them are feeling, and that's what we spent all last week in Washington, D.C., talking with the regulatory agencies about, to being pushed into the ditch, or in other words, they're being held underwater. They've got to get above water so they can get back on the road to lending, to having the capital adequacy and the liquidity they need to be able to make new loans and work troubled assets off their balance sheet. And when I say troubled assets, the vast majority of community banks are doing very well in this state, but those that are in trouble are generally in trouble because of their concentration in commercial real estate and in construction and land development, not because they made subprime mortgage loans, but they made loans to those businesses, particularly developers, and that were building our communities. And as you know, the value of those investments is no longer what it once was.
Thank you very much. Of course, to continue your analogy, we just have to make sure we don't overcorrect from our own
initial. Absolutely.
Representative Lizio?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First, I just wanted to, I'm sure I speak for the committee in expressing my disappointment that Representative Benz wasn't on the short list for the Supreme Court. I know.
You're here.
I think if he'd been a woman.
Yeah.
Anyway. Mr. Embry, I also serve on the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, and this morning we cut OHSU's budget by 10%, which was considered a victory of sorts. Although Dr. Robertson, the president of OHSU, who, by the way, is he's an MD and an MBA. He said his biggest concern was what was going to happen to the research and development, because it's a little bit harder to measure, and some of the cuts would have the effect of reducing their ability to do the research and development that they are known for and are trying to do. So we're looking at budget cuts for the university system in Oregon to the tune of about 16.5-17%, plus cutting the chancellor's office, which provides all the support services for all the universities, by 25%. So I guess I'm curious, because you work with a variety of states, what would your message be to this legislature about the wisdom of doing that, and how do we compare with the states with which you work?
Chair Reed, Representative Blasio, thank you for the question. It's the problem with the kinds of cuts that you're describing is often the support infrastructure is what gets weakened inside the research institutions. And so to give you a good example, I believe at Portland State there are no longer any laboratory technicians, so the people whose professional career is keeping the equipment running, making things. So a lot of things that are necessary inside, especially physics labs and other kinds of the hard sciences, you actually have to make some of the apparatus, because they don't really exist for the kinds of research. So having technical people on staff that have the skill sets and the work experience to be able to build those kinds of apparatus and keep them operating is incredibly important to the research enterprise. And many times the research grants don't have provisions for those built into them. So you'll see many of the foundations around here, particularly the Murdoch Foundation, in many cases will offer grants for equipment and equipment maintenance, but those come very periodically. I had a meeting yesterday, and I have a meeting this afternoon. I get back to my office with people who used to be research scientists and are moving into other career fields because of the reduction in budget and support for the university system. And this isn't to imply these aren't good scientists. We see it with every down market. People who are relatively young scientists don't have an established track record for grants inside the principal granting agencies, and they leave the field, which again is a source of brain drain for us. So I think one of the things that continuing to support higher ed is important, education across the board, K-12. I think one of the things that I guess frustrates me as a citizen is we need to make up our mind: are we going to have a centralized education bureaucracy and payment system, or are we going to have a decentralized one? And so we're kind of half pregnant. We still have a lot of the infrastructure left over from the pre ballot measure 5 that had the multiple school districts and the whole financial infrastructure for a local financing mechanism, but the financing now all comes out of Salem. So it's sort of like we have 6 of one, half a dozen of another. With our structure for especially K-12, higher ed is in distress all across the country. It's in severe distress in California. So I imagine when you were in your hearings talking to the folks at the University of Oregon, they actually see their enrollments in California going up fairly dramatically. I don't know about the rest of the OUS schools. I serve on the OUS Research Council, which is the research deans and the tech transfer community. And they're continuing to try and find other mechanisms, other sources of money that will offset what has traditionally come from the legislature. I wish I had a keen insight on what you can do, but given the restrictions and the demands on the budget dollars, it's what is our willingness as a society to fund and push forward on. Oregon's probably in slightly better shape than Washington, based on what we saw up there. I'm not sure about Idaho, but Idaho doesn't have nearly the research infrastructure that Oregon has. But I do see other states, such as Montana, that have continued to grow their research base probably at a disproportionate greater rate than Oregon has over the last 10 years. So it's a mixed bag. And I think we'll have to wait and see what happens to California which is certainly one of the stronger R&D centers in the world. But I think it's going to be a conundrum for the next several sessions.
So Representative Betts has a question. A quick follow-up on that. Have you seen in other states any innovative ways of connecting the research capabilities of the universities with the private sector? Obviously, we've been trying to do that with the Oregon Innovation Council, but are there other mechanisms that are helping to connect people like you who have an interest in commercializing what's being generated in universities?
Well, and Chair Reed, what's interesting in terms of it would be a very long discussion in terms of what's happened to the venture capital business and commercialization over the last 25 years. But increasingly more and more universities are trying to take that on themselves because the venture community has moved further downstream and is even more so in this recession than I've seen in a long time. The good news is, Oregon startups are on a level playing field. The bad news is the reason they're on a level playing field is the venture community is so retreated. They've taken to saying they're in the bunker with pillows over their heads. They've literally forgotten what business they're in. So they're looking for companies that are cash flow positive to invest in as venture capitalists, which is absurd, but that's what they've taken to. So the university community for the last 15 years has increasingly moved more and more towards trying to get things pre-commercialized themselves, which we frankly don't think that's the best business for them to be in. But it's just that the gap has gotten so large. You could find this by talking to folks at Oregon State and things that they've done with both HP and Intel, onshoring some of their R&D, so doing the contract research inside the engineering schools has increased dramatically as the amount of money going into commercial labs has declined over the years. A number of these companies have put more and more money into sponsored research inside the universities in the U.S. and now increasingly offshore. So there a lot of the funding for research universities in China and India come from global companies.
I promise this is the last follow-up representative. Is there danger in that in that the research gets increasingly directed by HP or Intel or someone else and doesn't have the freedom to go where science takes it?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is danger in that. One has to hope that there's, if there's altruism that comes out of that, it's that there are employment opportunities for the students that are being educated there. But, yeah, there's definitely danger in it becoming too commercially focused. There are great advantages to university R&D being fairly general in its scope.
Representative Betts.
Mr. Chair, this is going to be a slight digression from the theme that you guys have been addressing, but excuse me, it seems to me that the current situation is a reflection of dramatic overspending for the past 10 years to the point of, just best embodied now in the $10 trillion debt that we enjoy. So I wonder what you two think we should be doing. Should we be taking into account the very real possibility of much higher federal income taxes to try to address that debt in every one of our conversations? And the impact, the negative impact that's going to be having upon all of our economic activity in this state. And we're starting to see this happen already because our dollar is starting to weaken. So we know what's going to happen. And it almost just seems as though there's this willing suspension of disbelief as we mosey through our activities here in this building. And I talked to the state economist 2 days ago about this exact issue, and his thinking was that there wasn't much we could do about it, just ride it out. I think it was his, and he's probably right, it's a federal issue. But that's one point. The second is this. We seem to have addressed or shifted our focus when it comes to economic development toward energy, which makes sense because, of course, we import it, so there we're not cannibalizing each other to a huge extent by trying to replace foreign energy with local sources. We're going to play that out fairly quickly for reasons that have to do with the cheapness of oil. What is the next big thing So those are two simple questions.
No, you start with the first one.
30 seconds.
Right. And also, you might address why I'm not, you know, nominated for this.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm certainly not the most qualified person to address our some of our broadest economic issues. I sat through a presentation by an economist, John Mitchell, some of you may know him, yesterday, and have sat through presentations by all of our regional economists in the last, you know, 60 days, and every single one of them raises a different concern. I mean, the issue about rising federal taxes, that possibility is very real. How is the Fed going to respond with monetary policy? That's another issue that we really don't know. Will we see inflation? Will we see deflation? And what are the ramifications? I think the economic questions are, they far exceed my knowledge to analyze, but I can tell you there's also all these new issues in this environment. For example, the ownership of the government, of corporations, the fact that certain auto companies are going to be owned 70% by the federal government. What's the implications of that? Will they be able to orderly, in an orderly fashion, close a company if need be, if they own 70% of it? I mean, I'm raising more questions and not helping with any answers, but I think the fact is that we do, to some degree, while staying engaged, have a lot to ride out in this economy, because these aren't just Oregon issues. They're international issues, and they're issues certainly that are top of mind at the federal level. Not to digress, but I did want to point something else out. I was thinking about the concept of engaging in these discussions in the interim, and what are some of the innovative ideas. One of the thoughts that comes to mind, the capital purchase program was actually quite an innovative proposal by the U.S. Treasury. Unfortunately, it was completely demonized and turned into something that's so negative that most of the banks that receive capital under the capital purchase program don't want anyone to talk about it, don't want it. They're deploying it the way they need to deploy it, but it's like, maybe I should just give it back. Which I want to point out in the discussion of economic development is the opposite of economic development. Here we are as a state, just like all states, encouraging economic stimulus dollars from the federal government to flow into our state and looking at how we can best deploy those dollars to stimulate business growth and create jobs in our economy. The way the capital purchase program worked, and I point this out because I've given some thought and some of my members have sat around talking about whether there could be some sort of similar innovation at the state level to stimulate credit. But basically what it was designed to do is through a preferred stock investment with warrants that are already increasing in value and dividends, the Treasury took an investment in healthy, viable banks. Those banks do not lend that capital out. They leverage it 7 to 10 times with deposits and other sources of funds, and they loan it back out to who in this state? Small businesses. So one of the most important ways that banks have that participated in any of these federal programs have been able to help economic development is by leveraging the $214 million, or I think it's $270 million, that flowed into our state 7 to 10 times in loans to businesses in our state. And I think there's some creativity in there, some true benefit there. The government's going to make money. They have to go from 5% to 9% in the dividends they pay in 5 years, so there's an absolute incentive to pay it back. But all that was lost in translation. And I think if we could somehow talk in the interim about some of using the state bonding authority, perhaps talk about some innovative ways that similar types of investments, rather than just offsetting expenditures for certain industries or, you know, whatever the initiative is, I think there's other ways where the taxpayer ultimately can financially gain, and they can, and those dollars can be leveraged and to support innovation. Similarly, I'll just comment real quickly that we do enjoy very much the partnership we have with Oregon Economic and Community Development Department programs right now, the Capital Access Program, the Credit Enhancement Fund. We also work with SBA and USDA, and these government sponsored programs that have certain kind of guarantees, they also very much help certain kinds of businesses obtain credit that otherwise wouldn't qualify for the same level of credit without that additional support. So I think there's some chance to look at some of those programs and how they're being deployed right now and whether they could be structured to more keenly focus on certain sectors or certain certain aspects of the business community that we want to see grow. So I think there's a lot to talk about.
There certainly is that.
Representative Banks.
You can answer his question.
Well, your first question scares me, but that's but then so does the second one.
The third one, on the other hand, though.
That's the one.
I'm actually going to come up with. These are the first two. The first question, in terms of the deficit spending, we're concerned about that because the large deficit and continued deficit spending can be a real have a very negative effect on innovation. Everybody gets worried about how are we going to pay for this, and begins looking to. It's sort of like if you get behind in baseball, you want somebody to go up and hit the home run. There probably aren't very many home runs here. They're going to get us out of this. It's going to have to be done somewhat systematically, but also thoughtfully. And we don't want to stifle innovation in the process, because that's one of the things that has been our success in this country for a very long time. And I'm concerned that we may have collectively decided we're not good at it anymore. In reality, we're still very good at it. The U.S. Economy is roughly still five times the size of the Chinese economy. And as a investor in early stage companies, we're not afraid of China. In fact, we've got several of our energy technology companies began selling in China as raw startups very successfully. So the kinds of things that we like about this marketplace around sustainability and all that, it is a global opportunity. And it's one that I think, I hope, every state and every community embraces, because it cuts across every single business, every single industry. But I'm concerned that our focus on how grim things look from a financial point of view will sort of blind us to where some of the opportunities are. And something we've known, and it's not because we were smart guys, we sort of figured this out after being in the business for about 20 years, that down markets are the best time to start companies. And so right now, what I'm afraid is, by having this conversation now, is that we'll all do a really good job of sort of preparing ourselves, and by the time we kind of get ready to be enthusiastic about the marketplace, we'll have missed this entire innovation cycle and buy high and sell low. Because so many people have been so terrified about the conditions that they perceive in the market. And I actually think one of the reasons Oregon's unemployment rate is unnaturally higher, and it's usually higher than everybody else's, but unnaturally higher, for the first time in a recession, we have people in-migrating, not out-migrating. Every other recession before this, people left the state. That's not happening this time. So our unemployment rate's artificially high because a lot of the people who come here don't have jobs. So now, to jump over to your second question, if I may, quickly, what's the next big thing? I always worry about that from the point of view of trying to be laser focused as opposed to a little fuzzy around the edges. I find the discussion about foreign energy actually amusing. We get most of our imported oil from Canada, and we all know that the despots up there are pretty hate us. The thing that's interesting in all this discussion about electric vehicles, where most of the lithium salts come from for lithium batteries that are now going into electric vehicles, 60% of it's in China and Chile. So if we're going to talk about foreign sources of energy, and then we're saying we're going to go to an infrastructure around electric vehicles and other sources that are driven by at least lithium-based batteries. We don't have it here either. So it's going to be an interesting discussion. So what I would suggest is that in terms of looking for the next big thing, be thoughtful about what the consequences of decisions and programs and actions are. And I'll give you a very specific one. We're investors in a company called Plastifuel. Plastifuel has a very interesting technology that converts mixed waste plastic, and we're talking about stuff that otherwise goes into landfills. It can't be sorted. Turns it back into petroleum at a very high efficiency. And this is petroleum that goes directly into a refiner's input up in Washington. So all the oil they produce from the plastic that they reduce back into oil goes directly to a refinery. They don't qualify for the Betsy, because when the Betsy was first designed, it was so narrowly prescribed that it precluded something like Plastifuel. So what I would suggest is, as we look at opportunities around energy and the environment, be a little fuzzy around the edges and think about the short-term and then long-term consequences of some of those decisions about how things are characterized.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I've just been fascinated by the conversation and appreciate all the comments. I want to just step back for a second about the, I think I'd mentioned this committee before, looking at the Locate Center at the University of Oregon as being one of those models that does leverage financial input from private sources and leverages their research at their center for a vast amount of industries that are located in Oregon now. But I'm listening to Ms. Navarro, I find myself in almost total agreement with everything she said, believe it or not. Because we've spent a lot of time together over the last year and a half or so over mortgage lending and the loan products that were out there and the whole financial credit markets, not really being what I guess the country is or the world has figured out was a sustainable practice of their industry. And notwithstanding, it probably had very little to do with individual banks in Oregon, but it seems to me that she had made a couple of comments I'd like to follow up on, and more of a question for her, I suppose, and the banking industry than any other, because as the government found out that financial credit markets were not on a sustainable path because of the various risky loan products that were being put out there, or maybe it was those loan products in the secondary markets after they got secured and then sold off, and there was really not the underlying value in the dollar amounts that were being sold. It seems that we've reacted to that, as she knows. She's been dealing with the reaction from the federal government and from our state government at the same time, trying to deal with ensuring that there's sustainability in those lending practices. And so we struggled very hard trying to make sure we weren't over-regulating at the state and disadvantaging our local small community banks as opposed to giving an unfair advantage to the national banks, and tried to come up with a system that really did that, and certainly the federal government laid the basis for that in lending. So I guess getting down to it, she made a comment that she felt like the smaller banks in the state of Oregon are being pushed off into the ditch. If I wasn't sure, and I wasn't sure who was pushing them off in the ditch exactly, and what the state's reaction should be to that particular issue, if in fact it is a real issue that jeopardizes our local banks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for those comments. To clarify what I meant by the analogy to going down a road and going into the ditch, four banks that have gone off the road. So we're talking about some of the small banks. There are certain regulations, certain restrictions on brokered deposits, for example, or how you can classify certain assets, what you have to write down, that make it very difficult to recorrect themselves. Those are federal regulations. So when I talk about regulators, I'm not, you know, honing in at all on the Department of Consumer and Business Services and their role as the state bank regulator, but rather the application of those regulations that comes from the mandates primarily from the FDIC and the federal regulatory agencies. Certainly to support banks in staying the course and continuing to be viable businesses in this state, it's helpful when those leaders in our state and public policymakers are vocally supportive. And we have been, you know, certainly talking to leaders in this state over many months, and many of you, about, you know, the role that our members play in their communities, and hopefully as decision makers, policies that you adopt reflect that. There are two major things happening at the federal level that will impact the state also as part of all this discussion. One is that the credit markets that you referred to and lending in general is being subjected now to a complete new look at systemic regulation. Bank regulation and regulation of systemic risk in the financial institutions. So this could be investment banks. AIG, for example, is an insurance company. Non-banks, companies not regulated like banks, what their role will be in terms of regulation, as well as the whole question of the state charter and the national charters on the table. Who would be the primary regulator? When we were back in Washington last week, they're posturing already, even between the agencies. You know, who's going to be in charge of what? And so I think that debate is going to be very important for the state to weigh in on, because the state of Oregon regulates 34 banks headquartered in this state, and they certainly have a role to play in that debate. The second piece I'll just tell you is the mortgage lending regulations are not done. I mean, as you know, they're continuing to debate new legislation all the time around mortgage lending practices, and one of the most significant pieces that I don't think anyone's completely coalesced around yet is the question of skin in the game. And part of, you know, part of that is a portion of each mortgage that's made. And again, I think this is a national issue, but should the originator of mortgages have to maintain some portion of skin in that mortgage, rather than what happened before, which was you could make a loan, originate a loan as an individual. You could take your fee for originating that loan. You can always find somebody to finance that loan. Who's going to sell that loan, repackage it, slice and dice it, and next thing you know, no one's got really control over that product. Why? Because house values kept going up. As long as house values were going up, so what? If someone got in trouble, you know, they could sell their house. That was the theory some had. Well, guess what? Now, you know, you can't, and you're in trouble, and we've seen that happen. So I think that'll be a big part of the discussion is, you know, should originators have to maintain some sort of responsibility for that loan on some level after it's made. So,
thanks for that little side trip over to the Consumer Protection Committee. That was a good little summary of sounds like some of what you've been working on. If there aren't other questions, I want to go back just to what you were saying for a minute, Wayne, when you were talking about timing. That was really interesting to me that we might be getting into, if I heard you correctly, sort of the opposite timing of what we should be. So, and that makes sense to me that we, as general rule, we tend to overreact and overcorrect, maybe to go back to that other analogy. What do you think we should be doing then? Am I hearing you saying now is not the time to be going, or if we could be instantaneous in our enthusiasm, maybe it is, but given that it might take us some time to get there, how do we proceed?
Chair Reed, thank you. I think it's the, if it could be instantaneous, it would be on some of these things at some level. I think a lot of the regulatory issues are ones which, you know, from my perspective on the financial markets, if I could snap my fingers, it would reinstate Glass-Steagall instantaneously. It was one of the worst things we ever did as a country to kind of remove the boundaries between a lot of these entities. And I'm sure some of your members might disagree with that, but I think there's probably a lot more that would like to see some of those boundaries put back in place. Because I'm not sure how you unwind some of the things that we've done with some of the large financial services companies. It's hard to figure out what exactly they are now and what services they offer. I think it's caused damage all the way along the line in terms of the services offered to the range of companies from the very small all the way to the very mature. And I think we're seeing this in some respects with GM and the auto companies. I think the other is on the regulatory front around regulated utilities. One of the issues I think we've got to address in this country is we've got rules and regulations beginning with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, each individual state's public utility commissions, the legislative committees inside each legislature that have rules over that, and this literally goes right down to the county code agent. So if, in many cases, if you want to put a solar panel on your house in a planned unit development, you may not be able to do that, even though federal policy, state policy, county policy may be all in favor of that, but you may have rules around the placement of alternative energy systems on your home that are precluded by all the terms and condition of your planned unit development. So there's a regulatory a need to harmonize regulatory influences that I think sweep across the business, the sustainability, and the energy policy in this country. And you guys could spend the entire interim on that one alone, just trying to crack that. But from a timing perspective, taking it back to that, I think it's been almost 30 years since we've seen a recession as severe as this. So a lot of people kind of forgot what it felt like, and so I think we all pulled back, or most people pulled back so far. Unlike the recession in the 80s, this hit the financial infrastructure across the board so severely that everybody wants to wait and see how it's going to sort itself out. Well, while we've waited, we've had a six-week rally on the stock market. And while we've waited, new businesses have been created. We've got, in the last 6 months, I can't remember what the statistic was in the Oregonian, but a year-over-year rise in Portland of a 10% increase in the number of business formations. So I think the financial markets, I think, are kind of behind the power curve on what's happening in the rest of the economy, quite frankly. And I think a lot of it is we're waiting to see what Washington's going to do. We're waiting to see what the individual states are going to do, whether it's around tax policy, whether it's around how to spend the TARP money or the stimulus money or whatever it might be. And so I think one of the things I mentioned to you is, for example, the Oregon Growth Account. One of the things that specifically focused on money out of the lottery going into firms that can invest in early stage companies, that money has now been cut by half for 4 years.
The bill hasn't passed yet, but certainly the bill. You're right.
Just saying the general direction.
You're right.
That it's moving in.
Not everyone is supportive of that, but I understand your point, certainly.
But in terms of a opportunity, one of the most innovative programs in the U.S. was an entity called the Ben Franklin Partnership that was set up in Pennsylvania I think 30 years ago at this point, so actually during the recession of the 70s. It still exists, and it's been very, very effective in working with the university, the intersection of the university's innovation and the startup community. It was done because everybody had had dropped the curtain on the Rust Belt, and Pennsylvania decided that they needed to compete. And we've seen a complete rebirth of Pittsburgh during this 30-year period. And a lot of it is attributed to the city of Pittsburgh taking a step back and saying, what can we be, as opposed to what have we been? And very much looking future-oriented and really flexing off of Pitt and Carnegie Mellon as the center of Pittsburgh. And it's generated a huge renaissance there, particularly around medicine and biotechnology, but also now increasingly around the engineering sciences.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forgot I had a question, but after Representative Holy, I don't blame you. Although I'm grateful to Representative Holy for asking his questions exactly as I write them, he did leave out something I'm interested in. But first, will you forgive me and remind me of your title and station in life?
Chairman Reed, Representative Gilliam, I'm a managing partner of Reference Capital Management.
Reference Capital, thank you. I'm sorry, I forgot.
That's all right.
And he wanted to know your name as well.
That's Wayne Embry.
We didn't catch it down here, evidently.
This is Wayne Embry.
Oh, okay.
Not the basketball player.
Oh. So, you first said, that our venture capitalists have kind of gone downstream, and then you corrected yourself, I think, and said more appropriately they've gone into the bunker. We've addressed this a little bit, but can you just say a little bit about what it is you think we could do, not today, but over the interim or the next session, to encourage venture capitalists to come back and play in the game? Do we leave them alone? Do we continue on a different path? I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
Chair Reed, Representative Gilliam, that's a great question, and it's one that very often the default position is to go beat up on the Treasury. And while I don't necessarily agree with some of the investment policies and asset allocation of the Treasury, it's actually only a small small part of the issue. I think if you look at the Oregon, actually even the Northwest, and you look at where the sources of money for funding innovation and where is it spent, basically this region exports most of its money out of the region across the board. And I think one needs to ask the question why. The reality is over the last 20 years, the research institutions have grown consistently, so we seem to be doing the right thing. I mean, in spite of the underfunding of K through 12 and higher ed, the research institutions are growing. They have national reputations for R&D in many of their programs. They consistently win recruitment battles against Harvard and Stanford and other places. So from that perspective, they're doing the right thing. So those are things we've all been told for a million years in economic development, education and higher ed, research and development, and we're doing those things. But yet the amount of money being invested in startups here has actually declined, not increased. And part of it's a function of when you look at the sources of money, the Treasury, large foundations and endowments, and those entities that typically invest the excess capital they have in things like private equity and venture capital, none of it's invested in local managers. So we have a systemic problem in this state in terms of sort of funding our own innovation. And it's interesting, as I've got a essay written in 2006 by the fellow who had just stepped down as the head of the University of Texas Investment Management Corporation, the foundation for the University of Texas, at that time the third largest endowment in the country at $15 billion for a university endowment. This guy had been at a bunch of other places, including California Public Employment Retirement System as an investment manager. So he had certainly moral authority to speak on the topic. And he basically said the same thing was happening to Texas. The Texas institutions weren't supporting their own venture capital industry with money, and so therefore the startup environment was suffering as a result. Now, I'm not suggesting that there'd be you know, public policy requirements or legislation that forces people to invest locally. I mean, they have to maintain their own fiduciary standards. But I think it is something, and I, over the last couple of years, I was hoping the Oregon Innovation Council was going to look into this, but I haven't seen any signs that they have. That, you know, understanding why we're not willing to invest in ourselves. We certainly have plenty of opportunities. We've invested in, as I said, locally in probably 60 companies, and a number of those companies are still standing, independent companies that have performed very well and generated top-tier returns as investments. So we know that the capability exists here, that the capacity is here. What we just don't understand is why there isn't the follow-on.
Is part of that the human resource, that when a startup gets to a certain stage and the folks who want to invest are more comfortable with the various people they'd like to have involved, those people are not in Oregon? Is that, I'm having a little trouble understanding what you mean by investing in our own.
Well, Chair Reed, it's we haven't built the infrastructure here. So we started to have it in the 1980s. Actually, on a, if you look at venture capital investments as a percentage of the total pie.
What sort of infrastructure do you mean?
The investors who actually live here, work here, invest here.
Yep.
Unfortunately, what we've done, you know, both through the Oregon Growth Account and the Oregon Investment Council, the what look like local investments are actually made in funds that, that don't. You know, the partners don't live and work in Oregon.
Okay.
They're elsewhere, and then it's sort of implied, gee, it'd be nice if you'd come here and shop once in a while. But the reality is venture capital is a local business. It actually is a cottage industry, and you need to invest in people who are going to work the, you know, the local fields, as it were. And so we just haven't invested in that infrastructure of the partners and the individuals who will look for opportunities locally and maintain an interest in those companies at a local level.
So then maybe the follow-up to what Representative Gilliam was asking is, which comes first? Do you have, is it a matter of connecting the opportunities that are here with people who aren't here, or do we have to get those people here first to discover the opportunities?
Well, Chair Reed, that's, you know, the quintessential chicken
right?
and egg question.
Yes.
We would maintain, just based on our own experience and track record, that the opportunities are here.
Yeah.
And that the knowledge base is here. It comes down to, you know, is there a willingness to actually you know, bet on investing locally and replicate that, you know, more so than we've done.
Representative Good.
One last thing. We've asked you so many questions here. It's time to go, but this is not a discussion for today, but I observe that folks that do get a little dough, they may not become venture capitalists, but we encourage them to leave before their dough is taxed. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge drain, but that's another subject. I wanted to ask you if you know of Reclaim up in Boardman.
Chair Reed, Representative Gilliam, I do.
And that, to me, that's an impressive operation. I haven't checked in on them in quite a while, but, you know, they just turning tires back into the original products with no byproduct when there's one tire for every man, woman, and child in this country thrown away every year is incredibly interesting. And that's an example of a place I think that we ought to be encouraging and helping in any way that we can. But I wanted to ask you a question, and I got a little carried away there, so I'll just leave it.
Did you forget it? Or
no, I'm just glad he knows about it.
Okay. Very good. Well, I guess the time is ticking, and we're quickly losing committee members. I'll give you a chance to kind of make any sort of closing comments, and if you felt like weaving in any assignments you might be wanting to give us as far as areas to focus on in the interim, I would certainly be interested in that.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I actually think it'd be helpful to perhaps, in a maybe a not a formal committee setting, but to bring together some of the bright minds in our industry, some of the CEOs of the local banks, to have this conversation with them, because I think you'll be more apt to come up with some clever ideas with those smart minds in the room. But I'd be happy to help facilitate that. I learned a lot, actually, today listening to Mr. Embry as well, and it gets me thinking about things. We talk all the time about investing in banks here in the state through deposits. I mean, how much of our deposits, our public deposits, are staying in the state of Oregon, particularly through the investment pool. There's a lot of those issues that I'm happy to help participate in, and I don't want to take up any more of your time. I don't know if I offered too much to the conversation, but I appreciated being a part of it, and I'd really like to bring some folks together who I think would add significant value.
Thank you. You definitely added.
Mr. Chair, I was going to add to what she's saying, bringing folks together, not just CEOs of banks, but I'm sure you have contact with many CEOs who are doing business in the state of a broad range of industries, not just targeted ones, and it would be good to hear from everybody.
Absolutely.
Good representation, anyway.
Great point. Thank you.
Chair Reed, members of the committee.
Mr. Chair, just a really quick comment, because I think one of the comments that you've made about making sure we invest in our own and looking at investing in our own capital and our resources here is also one of the things that's been troubling to me as I look at R&D, for example, and our collaboration with our university systems is, as we have continued to disinvest in higher ed and those top researchers and faculty people, as we lose them, so goes our best research and our best opportunities for innovation in the future and that kind of collaboration. Just a little side note, it kind of goes along with what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for having me here, and Representative Thatcher, you actually beat me to the punch. That was what I was going to suggest, is it would be very easy to get a group of entrepreneurs across a range of industries all have insights not only into the business community and the innovation community here, but also as it relates to sustainability and that entire market sector. So that would be a conversation that would be a pleasure to put together. I know that the people that I can think of off the top of my head would love to have it.
Well, look forward to it. Really appreciate you both being here. I wasn't totally confident about where it was all going to go and how it was going to shake out, but you've kept me very entertained, and I learned a lot, and I think you've set us off on a good course for the interim. So I really appreciate you being here,
and Chair,
sure we'll continue it.
Just want to be sure, we're so happy you came. You added a lot, but
yes,
it was worth it just to hear Representative Holvey say, "I agreed with everything Mr. Morrow had said."
I can get a copy of the tape.
It'll be on the web. You can have it. Oh, shit.
had to erase that part of you.
Yeah, exactly. Back it up. Hopefully there was enough laughter to cover up that last comment. Thank you very much. It's an odd thing to be getting ready to lower the gavel here for the last meeting of this session. Perhaps we'll be able to come back before we leave the building for another informational session, but we'll see how that goes. I appreciate all of you who are still remaining. That says something about you as individuals, and we'll have a little gathering next week to rehash our various exploits of this session. So anything else for the good of the order? I don't have to give any other notices because I don't have to carry anything
There's
else
nothing,
over.
Nothing to carry over.
So all I get to say is we're adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.